on this week's episode of The Freenoter, we look at performance, all the finer points of actually delivering your talk.
We celebrate an incredible speaker, Eva Kaur, who taught us that content trumps performance.
And we maintain our performance with this week's cocktail, a non-alcoholic drink that actually satisfies.
It actually does. All this and more on this week's episode of The Freenoter. So we have a great show today, and I actually wanted to get into today's show with a listener question.
Listener question?
I know, listener question.
I love
question.
Our listeners.
I know.
We need names for them.
We do. Well,
I mean, they're freenoters.
They do have names. So they need...
Well, all right, freenoters, here's your question.
And now, here's your long-distance dedication. Here's Journey with Separate Ways. So we had a listener write in. Terry, it's either Terry Majean or Terry Majean. And I'm going to go with Terry Majean.
So, sounds very fancy that way.
So sorry, Terry, if that's not it. But we do appreciate your question. And he wrote in, this past year, I was asked to give a talk on leadership. I am an executive chef that works with a team of 70 people, so leadership is critical in my role. I love the whole process of preparing, delivering, follow-up questions, and requests for my talk, and I'm thinking about pursuing speaking in addition to my current career. I gave the speech in my formal chef's coat.
I have been
asked to speak several more times this year, and here's my question, and thank you so much for this, Terry. What are your thoughts on me continuing to wear my chef's coat? I'm incredibly comfortable in my coat. In fact, I almost feel like I'm stepping into an alter ego when I put it on. Now, before we get to your question, Terry, that was submitted to thefreenoter@gmail.com. And we would.
That's right. Yes, what you said.
What I said was thefreenoter@gmail.com.
Thefreenoter@gmail.com.
Where we answer those emails, or we at least bring them into the show.
We at least receive those emails and
we do.
Yes, and then we answer them here.
We receive them and then by fiat, they are executed. So what do you think about Terry's question? Should he wear the chef's coat? And I have an answer for this. I can't wait to hear yours.
I say 100% yes. Wear
Why?
The chef's coat.
Why?
Well, a couple different reasons. One is, particularly if what he's talking about relates to his work as an executive chef, then it's one additional layer of kind of authority that you can telegraph with what you wear. There's actually really cool studies that maybe we can dig one out for our show notes about how people confer more authority on people who are wearing a white lab coat or a white coat, regardless of whether or not they're actually a doctor. But I have to think that at some level, that kind of physical, physical marker of authority makes a big difference. Second reason is something he said in his email. It makes him feel strong. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge part of what to wear on stage, is something that makes you feel strong.
So I am not going to disagree with you. In fact, I'm going to agree with you 100%, which is why I always wear marine dress blues.
You are not a marine.
Every time I talk. No, but I feel like one every time I give a talk.
Oh.
No, I think actually, and this really goes right into our topic today about performance. And I love the word that, or the phrase that he used. I almost feel like I'm stepping into an alter ego when I put it on. Mm. And there's a connotation of alter ego that is, fake, a performance, an act. But that's not how I read alter ego. Alter ego is another side of you. And if that side of you makes you feel strong, then I say, go for it. And also, we've talked about rhetoric on the show and the three components to an effective rhetorical argument and when to use them. And no small part of that, one of the triad, is ethos, credibility. And I think wearing, if wearing your chef's whites gives you an internal sense of power, it also gives you an external credibility, I think, that you are a leader of people.
Yeah, 100%. And another kind of swipe file study that backs that up, and particularly to your point of embodying a version of yourself that you feel is already there. There's just really interesting stories about and studies about embodying avatars. And that when people imagine themselves to be, let's say, a superhero, it actually does extraordinary things to their body chemistry, their likelihood to be kinder later. It's a really important thing. And it's actually a topic that Todd Henry gets into his book, Alter Ego. And, which is a book I have not yet read, though it's at the top of my nonfiction to read list. And one thing that I love about it is just this idea of even naming your alter egos. And I just think that that's a spectacular piece. So I think if you've got a way to physically embody that alter ego, then go for it.
Yeah, I've got one named Attila.
Well, I call my overly performance-y, and this, so again, ties into our topic this week, I call her Becky. I mean, it's like my middle name is Rebecca, which I'm so not a Rebecca. And so that's why anytime I feel like I go into presentation mode where I'm hey, everybody, I am here and I am speaking to you. That's Becky and I hate her.
Reminds me of a Simpsons episode where Bart is in an abandoned circus or carnival. And he finds a doll of Al Gore and he pulls the string of it and it says, "You are listening to me talk."
Yeah, that's what happens when Becky gets on there.
I know. Yeah. Made of wood, that one.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, it's fair to say that, again, an alter ego is not necessarily a mask. I think it's just another side.
Yes. And I think that for all the reasons why you can't just pretend to be a thing, because there's, you know, there's physiology that humans pick up when you are not fully, when you are not 100% what you are saying that you are representing yourself to be. It's one of the things that I talk about a lot with folks with kind of, we haven't talked about it. This actually, my kind of four presenting personas.
My
little theory about that.
Yeah, we have not.
But what I reinforce with that is that you have to find that persona that you have off stage of one of those four that I talk about, and then use it on stage.
Why don't you just tell us what those four are? I mean, this may be a whole show, but let's at least use that as a way to kind of get into performance and what your alter ego might be.
Sure. So after observation of many, 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 many speakers, and also of my own work and all of that, and studies and research and whatever, I'm of the opinion that there are four what I call presenting personas. And they are a combination of how descriptive or prescriptive you are and how much you rely on logical versus emotional appeals is kind of the rough cut on it. You put those into a 2x2 matrix, like the MBA that I am. And you get four styles. And I call them the commander, the counselor, the storyteller, which is a new name for that one, and the sage. Commander tends to be very directive and very rational, relies very heavily on concepts, quotes, mantras, short statements. Storyteller, also very prescriptive, telling people what to do, but all very much more of an emotional appeal. And where the storytelling comes in, if you think of how most stories are used, is to tell a story of like, let me show you that this is the right answer. The counselor is emotional appeal, but is more descriptive. So the counselor often relies very heavily on interactions with the audience and exercises and applications, and really takes that kind of almost coach approach. And, you know, I'm here with you in the trenches kind of attitude. And then the last one, the sage, as you might imagine, is the last combination we haven't talked about yet, which is descriptive but rational. So somebody who tends to rely very heavily on data and research, but really focuses on insight. And I am of the opinion that the best performers on stage are able to tap into all four of those personas and then rotate very elegantly between them. I think everybody has a natural one that they prefer. But I think really, really great speakers and freenoters, you actually can't really tell which is their preferred one because they're so facile at going in between. So which one are you, would you say?
Well, I think naturally, I think people would assume I'm a sage. My job as a freenoter is to be a sage.
Yeah.
I guess I balance that with storyteller.
Yeah.
Because I think that provides a nice counterweight, because I present very rational things and I try to always counterweight that with storytelling. And it's a different storytelling than the kinds of things that you do on stage. And that's going to be brought up in our next episode, actually, thanks to a listener question, which will be fun.
Yeah. Well, and what you're doing is what I typically recommend to people, is that whatever your dominant one is, one of the first things you can do to balance out and improve your performance is raise your skill in the opposite, in the diagonal opposite. So I had a speaker one time at TEDx Cambridge when I was executive producer there, whose dominant style was Commander. So, you know, he was talking about CRISPR, DNA, and he was just,
I mean, he was
so passionate about what he would say, but he would say everything was a declarative sentence. And because he was so passionate, he just sounded angry all the time. And, you know, when I pointed this out to him, he's like, yeah, people tell me that. But he didn't really know how to fix it. And so, you know, one of the things that once I explained this whole piece to him and I said, you know, hey, the first thing is like, just like tap into your inner counselor. He's like, I don't know how to do that. And I'm like, but you have a son, right? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, how old's your son? He's 3. I said, so how would you say that same line if it was your son? And it radically changed. And one of the coolest things was, is that that same speaker came back 2 years later to give a different TEDx Cambridge talk. And his presenting style was so different. And, you know, I asked him about it. I said, it's so markedly different. He said, it's all about the counselor. He's like, just my ability to go back and forth, even between those two, made such a difference. He said that even other people started to notice and compliment him on the shift in his performance skills.
You know, one of the things that I have to work with when I'm speaking is that, you know, often people will tell me they're not great with numbers, right? I present a lot of research and I don't actually believe that no one is not great with numbers. I think we have preferences and we tell ourselves stories and things like that. But one of the things that I know that I have to do, because ultimately the end goal of what I am presenting is a rational, authoritative take on the research that we present, is that my performance style has to disarm.
Yeah.
And in some, and in some cases for people, it's the exact opposite. Maybe you're dealing with something that's a very, you know, a soft skill or a fuzzy topic. And actually your performance, has to, again, sort of appeal to the opposite a little bit, to disarm. And by disarm, I don't mean, manipulate at all. It's just to try to chip away at the internal resistance to what you're saying. And honestly, when I think about performance, that's about as far as I take it. But a lot of times when people get speaking advice and they look for, you know, speakers to teach them how to speak better, you get a lot of performance tips, you know, start with a joke or always make eye contact, like really awkward eye contact with that one person, the entire, like, you know, and I don't particularly think those are great tips. And it sort of brings up a question that I'll ask you. A lot of those tips, I think, are kind of tips for actors. Are speakers actors?
Oh, that's a good question.
I know.
Well, the first thing I want to say real quickly before we get there is that my experience is that most issues with performance can be fixed in the content. And so, you know, to the point that you were making earlier, and I thought this is where you're going, is one of the reasons why I always suggest that folks, make sure that they're varying the kinds of content in their talk, because you're going to present data much differently than you're going to present a story or kind of your big point, or when you're doing an exercise with the audience, you naturally fall into a different style. Mm-hmm. And so the more that you can have different forms of content, I think you can embody those different styles. Now, is a speaker an actor? I think in the sense that they are embodying and a version that of themselves that is heightened, where they are more of themselves. They are the kind of best version of themselves. I think there is that aspect of it. I think it was Dale Carnegie that said, again, back in my favorite speaking book from 1917, that a presentation is a conversation enlarged. Love that. I, however, would caution every speaker and freenoters in particular, just generally because that's not what they're doing all the time, to just banish that sense of actor out, because it's that kind of performance that I find to be the most off-putting when I see somebody get up and speak, when it feels like a quote unquote performance with a capital P. Yes, it's a performance. You need to perform. And Michael and Amy Port do a lovely job of distinguishing between those two. But I just think if you start to think of yourself as an actor and that you have to go up and do a thing, well, then that's, I mean, that's where Becky comes from. Like that, you know, and I had to kill that off. And that's part of the reasons why I developed my, you know, that presenting persona approach, because it was a way for me to think about my performance on stage that felt natural.
Yeah.
Where I was just like, well, let me tap into those moments where, you know, we've talked a lot about how the fact that I didn't feel that I was funny on stage, like it was a, and that I spent like a year with that as my focus. How can I be funny, but how can I be fun? And part of that was tapping back into, well, what am I doing in those moments, those storyteller moments off stage where I'm making you laugh or I'm making other people laugh? And I was just like, well, or back in my Weight Watcher leader days, like what did I do then? And then I just brought that back. And yeah. So I don't think that's acting. I think that's embodiment. And I think embodiment is a much better term of art to have in your head as a speaker than actor.
I agree. And I think you can get some bad advice on performance, I think, you know, to,
some terrible advice.
To, you know, over emote and, you know, raise the stakes and really sell the emotion of your story. But if that's not who you are, it's going to show, because you're not, and forgive me, all of our listeners, maybe there are some exceptions out there, but we're not actors. We're not professional actors. We can act, we can deliver a performance in a high performance situation. But like, it's not in me to make you cry. Like, I don't have that skill. I'm not going to be able to get up there and tell a story that's going to make you cry, because that's not who I am. It doesn't serve the kinds of things that I present.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I might make you laugh, but I think what's most important is for me to deliver what is congruent with me.
Yes,
right?
100%. That's what comes, that in fact is what a great performance actually is. And like I said, with this kind of mental image of, or this idea of a conversation enlarged, yeah, there is a difference between how I speak and perform on stage and I do off stage. It's, I do have an ability to kind of strip out the kind ofs and the sort ofs and the filler phrases that I'm using right now on the podcast. Yeah. And the ums and the ahs. Like I have worked to drop out many of those. Not 100%, because research shows that people distrust people who don't actually have some of those. What are they called? I forget what it's called when you, the ums and ahs, there's a specific name for them and I don't know what it is.
Amanaz.
Do 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 do.
Amanaz.
Do 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 do.
Amanaz.
Do 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 do.
And this is brought to you by the number 3 and the letter B.
Okay. Anyway, yeah, I think, you know, to your point, the piece about being congruent with who you are, absolutely. But this is why I, you know, when I'm working with folks in performance, which I do almost always this now these days in collaboration with the fine gentleman, Dr. Nick Morgan of Public Words.
I assumed he would come up in this episode.
Absolutely. Because Nick is an actor. He has taught acting. He's also been a speechwriter for 25 years. He was a speechwriter for the governor of Virginia for a number of years. And he and I have all sorts of interesting conversations about this, because my background is not acting, at least as of like senior year of high school was the last time I was ever in anything official. You know, and so I'm not a trained actor, and you know, he's worked with so many people over the years where he is very strongly of the opinion that yes, this is about you kind of the whole acting thing, like don't try this at home. Like it takes years for an actor to truly be able to get to that, the kind of embodiment that they achieve. And it's not that you can't learn things and borrow things from there, but this congruency with who you are, I think is super important. And I also feel like it's important for people to hear advice around what makes for a good performance and put it through that lens of what is true to them. And you know this, but I do a lot of work with life scientists, engineers, and technologists. It's just, you know, I love science. I worked at Harvard Medical School for 3 years. You know, I speak science. And particularly between that and the work that I've done with TEDx Cambridge and a lot of the work I do with, you know, biotech and life science pharma startups here in town, these are not folks that are very comfortable putting their emotions out there.
No.
So,
and why should they?
Right, exactly. And they're speaking to people who are not comfortable with those.
That don't want
to
hear it.
Yeah. Exactly. So it's like, it's one of those reasons where, like, when it comes to the storyteller aspect, like, yes, even a scientist, even a sage persona needs to put some storytelling into their performance and into their talks and presentations to make them more effective, because story can be really powerful. But that's part of the reason why I believe very much in being able to tell other people's stories in an effective way, because a lot of science and technologists and me are not comfortable telling our own stories very well. But second, figuring out how to present information in a way that it feels like a story, even if it isn't one. So that's all to say there's many, many, many ways to achieve these different kinds of performance, whether you think about it in this, you know, presenting persona way or not. But all of it comes back to what feels comfortable for you. Not in the sense of, okay, you couldn't, like, there's a gap between where you could be and where you are based on developing additional skill, because I do believe in pushing yourself that way. But if something just fundamentally feels wrong to you, don't do it. Because that's going to show up on stage, and that's going to create a disconnection between you and the audience. And that's a fatal flaw when it comes to performance.
No, it really is. And I think an aspect of performance that, amongst speakers, I think gets short shrift. And it's, you know, if there's anything in my speaking that has improved the most, I hope it's all improved, but that has improved the most over the past 10 years, it's not what I'm saying or how I'm emoting. It's what I'm doing on stage. It's how I'm moving.
Well, tell me more about that.
So one of the things that I learned, from, actually, you mentioned Michael and Amy Port. They watched me speak, and I got some feedback, some solicited feedback on it, was that, you know, every time you sort of have a movement that is, you know, not congruent with the point you're trying to land. Like if you're trying to land a powerful point and you're like rocking backwards or you're like pacing or whatever, you leak power is I think the phrase for it. And as I began to get better with what I was doing with my body, when I wanted to make my most important points, I was still, I was stationary. My body was quiet and I slowed down.
Yeah.
And that had a huge difference in my actually landing the points I wanted to land.
Yeah. The way I love the physicality aspect that they brought to that. One of the things that I have used with myself and with folks that I have worked with on their performance, is an adaptation of, concepts that I learned at the great company Oratium, which does kind of boutique sales messaging training and, folks for companies and those kinds of things for companies. And so Tim Pollard, the head there, great book he wrote called The Compelling Communicator. Would recommend it. But from a delivery standpoint, one of his big points was always about signaling to the audience, like signal to the audience in your performance that a point is or is not more important to listen to. And so I kind of took that concept and I was like, well, if we're talking about signaling, let's actually apply a traffic signal to it. And so, the way that I've come to think about that, you know, various times or moments or the content of my talk is through the lens of a traffic light. So that, let's say 80% of a talk, I think, should be delivered at what I call green light, which is normal conversational speed, which a lot of people are scared of on stage. People are like, oh, people tell me I talk too fast and whatever. I'm like, no, you don't. You just don't give them time to process. But I mean, if you've ever heard someone who speaks really slowly, that gets really tiresome.
Going to edit that in post.
After a while. And so people want you to be speaking at a normal conversational pace. So that's green light. Yellow light, as I described to people, is, well, as you are supposed to do when a traffic signal goes to yellow, is you slow down. You know, it means warning, caution. And so I suggest that people move to the kind of a more of a moderated pace on those things. Those are new concepts. Those are definitions. Those are explanations of things that probably need a little bit more space. Like if I'm going to explain to people that 2x2 matrix, like I think I probably notched down my normal pace to talk about that, where I'm like on one axis is this, on the other axis is in this. And when you're thinking about it, blah, 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 and you pop back up to green light. And then of course that leaves red light, which are those moments where just like you were talking about, you stop, you pause, that's the time to slow way down. It's like when you've got that major point. And then after it's been given, light is green, go back to the pace. So those are another one of those ways that I think of performance in a way that kind of takes it out of this like super performy kind of way and just kind of brings it into more of a practical approach about how can you think about these things in a way that helps the audience hear which of these points is more important.
So I have not learned a lot about the craft of acting. I'm not an actor. I am a bit of an amateur magician. And, you know, a few of the things that I think are my biggest lessons about performance have come from some of the greats in magic. And so, I'd love to hear like two or three things from you that you've learned from your mentors, your peers, or about performance, but I'll start with mine. And I think the three things that I have taken from the world of magic that have helped me the most, and I'll go from kind of tactical to strategic here. The first is from a Spanish magician named Juan Tamariz, who is, I think, arguably the greatest living card magician, you know, close-up card magician on the planet, an amazing magician. And he wrote a book called The 5 Points in Magic, and you're not going to find it, and you don't have to read it. But one of those points is about the eyes, and, you know, in any sort of, like, bog standard speaking advice, you'll say make good eye contact. Well, what does that actually mean? Juan Tamariz goes into it in detail, and his vision when you step in front of an audience is that your job, think about there being threads attached to the eyes of every audience member going directly to your head. So if you're speaking to 2,000 people, there are 2,000 threads coming from their heads, coming right to your eyes. And your job when you get on stage is to gather all of those threads. So from front to back, left to right, you gather them all up. And the thing to know about that is that anytime you turn your back to the audience or otherwise stop looking at them, you must regather all of the threads.
How do you do that?
Again, it's a process where you slowly make sure that you make eye contact with everybody from front to back and don't turn your back to the audience. Like, I've done that before. And I, like, anytime I'm giving a slide presentation and there's a slide in back of me and I have to turn around and point to a slide, that I failed. I didn't know the slide by heart well enough. I didn't, you know, I should not have to break the threads to do that.
Well, or as Michael Port would say and has said, then make sure that is a choice where there are,
it is a choice.
There are moments where that actually is a wonderful thing to do. And to your point about, I know you don't do highly emotional things, but when it's actually can be a gift to the audience in a very emotional moment for you to break eye contact with them. Cause that actually releases them from, it gives them a moment to process. So
you're right. You know,
there are times when that's the right thing to do. But I love that mental image from
gathering the threads. Yeah. So it is a choice. You're right. And if you do it, you must then regather all of the threads.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take much to do, but it sort of touches everybody.
Yeah. I mean, the one that I kind of developed myself, which back in my Weight Watcher leader days was, you know, I realized that it was back, you know, it's the same issue. I went through the same evolution with Becky, as a Weight Watcher leader too. And then I eventually developed a mantra for Weight Watchers when I was leading those meetings where, you know, I just told myself to check my dignity at the door. And it didn't mean that I was not, that I was in, you know, indignant is not the right word. It didn't mean that I was undignified, but it meant that I needed to drop all of that to serve the audience and that I needed to be whomever they needed to be me to be in that moment in order to get that across, which meant that over time, it was just a reminder to me to just like stop, like drop any and all walls between me and the audience.
That's something that, Alex Bloomberg from Gimlet and Planet Money and Startup, an amazing interviewer, great podcaster, talks a lot about that. Your job as an interviewer is to be a fool, right? Is to know less than you think you know, because only then will you ask great questions, the questions that the audience would want to ask, but feels too ashamed to do.
But you said you had another one. I'd love to hear another performance thing.
All right. So it's just two more quick ones. One is from a magician named Nate Staniforth, who's an incredible magician, he's a finely honed killing machine on stage with just like, he does like five or six things every night and they just completely kill. And he is completely, we talked about being congruent with who you are, and he just ruthlessly looks at any part of his presentation and he asks, does that fight with the effect I'm trying to have? And that doesn't mean you have to be completely monolithic on stage, but if you are trying to land a point that if you're trying to get people to accept an idea that maybe they're not necessarily receptive to, then maybe the best approach is not to be challenging on stage, right? To make them feel like, you know, I'm smarter than you or I'm going to fool you. That's going to fight against the effect you want to have. And so what I love about Nate, he's 100% focused on the effect. And if that means that he has to slow down, that he has to simplify things, not crack a joke when he might otherwise want to, it's all in service of the effect. And I think that's great advice for any freenoter.
Absolutely. And I think that's actually where a lot of people go wrong too, is that they do things not for the effect of the point, but they do things for effect, period, without really thinking through, does it tie in? You know, I was reading the other day something that the author Stephen Pressfield wrote, and I love his blog, and it was a reference to the fact that when he's writing a book, he writes out the theme of the book on a piece of paper, and he tapes it to his typewriter, and he makes that decision at every moment, like, everything has to support and tie to the theme or it doesn't go in the book. And I think that that's a really important thing when you're thinking about, you know, like for instance, there's so much pressure on like, oh, you should be funny. I'm like, not always.
Not if you're not funny.
And I think everybody, that's probably a whole other topic.
I know. We should have Drew Tarvin on for that.
Show. I think everybody does have their own kind of funny, but that's the thing. You have to find your funny. Mm. And that to me comes back to that persona piece.
Yeah.
But there's one other thing. So I mentioned him earlier, but Tim Pollard gave me a great piece of performance advice once upon a time. And it's kind of indirect performance advice. Cause I would double click on all the other stuff you'd said about, you know, only move when the talk moves, you know, the Dale Carnegie's way that puts that, he says, restlessness is not an expression. Mm-hmm. And I just love that. But what Tim said to me, and I use it to this day. I tell it to other people cause it's so powerful. He said, when you seek the room's approval, you lose the room's respect. So stop trying. It doesn't mean that you can't be likable up there, but that it shouldn't be for the point of being likable. If you yourself are likable, then that will come through, but don't try to get them to go, oh, you're likable.
Yeah.
You want to come across with the point. Like, are you getting your point across? Are you moving people from one point to another? You know, not just emotionally, but rationally as well. And I think that's, I'm such a fan and such a believer in that, you know, anything short of that is emotional manipulation. And I think it cheapens what you could be doing on stage.
You can get that from speaker evals too. I mean, anytime you give a talk, where they're in a conference where there are speaker evaluations, you are always going to get one, two, three that are just terrible.
Yeah.
And you can discard those. But if you get more than that, then maybe you have a thing to look at, right? Yeah. Maybe what you have done has fought against what you intended your effect to be. And I always look at those. I try not to get too, downtrodden when I get a negative one here or there. But, if you have a number of people saying, you know, I couldn't take him serious or didn't seem to know what they were talking about, that may or may not be true, but that's definitely a referendum on your performance in some in some cases.
And particularly if those people are all saying the same thing, that's another time to 100%. to pay attention, because I think squeaky wheels squeak for a reason. You decide how long you can stand the squeak and if the squeak bothers you, but it's squeaking for a reason. And then you can decide whether or not to fix it.
So I want to go back to something that you talked about at the very beginning. And that is that content trumps performance.
I 100% believe that.
And I know you have some great examples about that. I think we've mentioned, Monica Lewinsky's TEDx talk, right?
Yeah. TED Talk.
Or was it TED Talk? Monica Lewinsky's TED Talk, yeah. Which she read from, like,
Well, it looked like she was reading. She knew that thing cold. I mean, she had the notes. She looked at it, I think, once, even though she was moving the pages. So she knew that thing cold, but it was written out 100%, word for word.
But the content and the structure of the argument were incredible.
Yep.
Like, agreed. it was completely compelling. And I know you have some other examples of speakers who do that. So it's, you know, it's not necessarily your ability to go up and be an actor or a thespian or emote.
It's one of the reasons why one of the TED talks or TEDx talks that I love to show people is Joe Smith's Paper Towel. And we've had to use one paper towel. Yeah. We've talked about it before, but one of the reasons why I love to show it is because there is nothing remarkable about his performance outside of the fact that he's doing a demonstration at all. And in fact, one of the things that I love to point out to people is he screws up the first line. He makes a mistake in his opening line. So it's a point in like beautiful carry on because like here's this great big TEDx talk and he like muffs the first line. And the second point that I make about that to people is like, did you remember that he did? Because you don't, you remember his point is so good and he lands the point so well that you absolutely forgive the fact that he's kind of awkward, that he kind of stumbles over what he's going to say, makes a mistake in his first line. And I love just showing examples like Joe Smith and our real hero of speaking for this week for just that reason.
For just that reason. And that does indeed bring up our real hero of speaking, the late Eva Kaur.
The late Eva Kaur. And again, full credit to this. This is a woman I was introduced to back in my days of working with Tim Pollard and Aratium. And she was such a great example of exactly this. So Eva Kaur was a Holocaust survivor. And she spent many of the last years of her life touring, particularly to high schools, talking about her experiences on behalf of a foundation, the Candles organization that she founded. You judge her on performance by all the things that people say you're supposed to do. She was terrible. And she had this like hugely thick, like Transylvanian accent. She was about like 4'5".
Oh,
and
yeah.
She sat. And she sat whenever she spoke. And she would also tend to speak down into the microphone. But the content of what she was saying was so powerful that you forgave all of that. And so, you know, while not everybody has as emotionally gripping content as Eva does and did, the point I think is still the same. And, you know, we can go back to Joe Smith. It's if your content is great, like the way our brains work, it's looking for kinds of information and kinds of orders. And you can do that and not be terribly charismatic on stage. You cannot be what somebody would point to as like, oh, fabulous speaker, and people will still walk away from it going, that was really, really good.
Yeah, she was amazing, and she was not just a Holocaust survivor. She was experimented on by Josef Mengele, she and her twin sister, and her message was about forgiveness. And like, I'm sorry if your message out there is forgiveness. You got trumped by her, because she, like, the power in her message had, the only performance aspect of it was just, you know, her, again, completely congruent and commitment to the narrative. But there, you know, there wasn't any acting going on because she done sung it.
Don't miss this either. You touched upon it. Like, it wasn't just story after story after story. She had, just by experimentation, paying attention to what people responded to and didn't. We had an opportunity to talk with her about how she did it. Like, over time, she developed like the right way to tell these stories and what worked and what didn't, and incorporating questions from the audience into how she told these stories in the first place. And so, you know, she crafted her content for maximum effect. Whether or not she realized it's because her performance wasn't going to be able to craft for maximum effect, I think that was really interesting. I actually saw a study just a couple weeks ago that said that that made a distinction between charisma and presence, and that, you know, I think a lot of times when we think of great performers, or some of the things that we hold up as great performers, or, you know, people who we see as charismatic, and what this article was talking about was that kind of charisma alone can sometimes actually get in the way of landing a message. Like, you know, so you can be so charming that people love you in the moment. And then, you know, it's like that meal that you eat. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, you don't even remember that you've eaten it. Right. So, I think yes, performance is important, because performance, you cannot get your presentation out there without actually delivering the talk somehow. And you want to make sure that you're not doing things that get in the way of people hearing that. But I think one of the things that I would often say to the folks I was coaching, and I guess still do on performance, is that while performance is the thing that people notice first, it's actually the last thing that they actually really, that you actually have to worry about. I mean, they'll notice it first, but actually, if you have substance to your talk, and if it's structured really well, and it's supported really well, then they will forgive performance. And so there's so much other stuff that you have direct control over that really can affect the impression of your performance, that's why I'm so passionate about, particularly with folks that are from technical backgrounds and whatever, saying there's a huge amount that you can do to make your quote unquote performance better that actually starts back in the content of the talk itself.
You know what dramatically affects performance?
Alcohol.
It does. So we're not going to have any tonight.
No, I know, because we're squeaking in under the wire with Dry January.
We are squeaking in with Dry January. Yeah, we decided that for the performance episode that we would maintain high performance. And we are enjoying a non-alcoholic cocktail that we have discovered recently.
Yes, it's delicious.
And I understand it's about to be heavily marketed in America, but it's from the UK. You can get it on Amazon. But there's a company in Britain called Seedlip. Seedlip, Seedlip. And they make currently three different distillates. And they're essentially what would go into a gin without the alcohol.
Yeah.
And if you just drink them by themselves, they're pretty watery.
Yeah.
But if you mix them with some kind of tonic or something with a little bit of sugar in it, they're really incredible. And so what we're having tonight is a Seedlip garden and elderflower tonic.
Delicious.
Yeah, the elderflower tonic you should be able to get at your local Harris Teeter Wegmans, Piggly Wiggly, whatever you do.
Roche Brothers in our case.
Roche Brothers here. And Seedlip Garden is it's like a gin with none of the alcohol. It doesn't have the body of a gin, but when you mix it with the elderflower tonic, it's really lovely. And it has this like fresh English garden tea flavor.
Yeah. And I think that might scare people.
Don't be scared.
The thing that that struck me about it when I first had it was just like, there's part of your brain that has to actually tell yourself that you're not drinking gin.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, you're not going to have, you don't have the kind of body that an alcohol has. And there's not the bite of an alcohol, but there's so much else of the experience of drinking a Seedlip cocktail. It fills in so many of those other pieces that it's just, I love them. Just for nights when we don't feel like drinking, or, as a way to kind of, you want to linger someplace, yeah. But you've had the cocktail that you want to have and you don't want to have anymore. And so, we actually love this so much that we convinced our neighborhood bar to start carrying it. Yes. And if we do put a link.
And we will.
I'll put my Amazon affiliate link. So we will have an affiliate relationship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Keep getting them checks.
But not from Seedlip itself. But I just want to be clear that if we put a link up, it's going to be that, we'll get like 2 cents off it.
So all right, 2 cents.
We'll use it to buy the makings for the next cocktail.
Well, I love it because it's not sweet. And like when you talk about mocktails, they're often atrocious abominations of grenadine and
right.
Yuck.
And very unfriendly, I think, to people who are conscious of their health and their calorie intake. And so, I mean, I still follow WW points, but if you're doing this with, let's say, the naturally light Fever Tree tonic, then this whole cocktail is a point.
Well, I think a point is a good place to end. We have scored a point. We have scored a point here. So on next week's episode of The Freenoter, we're going to dive deep into our listener mailbag. We've been getting lots of questions, Tamsin. I can't wait
questions.
To dive into
again,
this.
And they are sent to
thefreenoter@gmail.com.
That's right.
So we're going to talk about calls to action, what makes us, as in you and I, different as freenoters, and how to stay in touch with your audience.
We'll take a look at the work of Drew Davis, who has an incredible post-talk system, or process really, for maximizing audience engagement after the talk.
And we'll enjoy our own Webster family take on the martini, because Dry January is over now.
Happy February.
Happy February.
All that and more on the next episode of The Freenoter. Cheers.
Cheers.